Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to Two Guys in a Bible here on Fulfilled Radio, a voice you can trust. My name is Don K. Preston. I'm the president of Preterist Research Institute of Ardmore, Oklahoma. Over here is William Bell, the president founder of allthingsfulfilled.com. You can catch William every Saturday evening at 7 o'clock on Now TV. You can catch me on Now TV every Friday morning at 9:30. And William does YouTube videos as well. I do YouTube as well. We both have websites that you can check out with tons and tons of information, all free of charge, free for download, free for distribution, and what have you. So avail yourself of all of that information. And William, I was sharing with you before we came on air, and before I messed that up, however I did that, really been an exciting day in a couple of different ways, but nonetheless, first of all, I was contacted today. I'm not going to give names at this particular point except one. Well, I don't think I'll even give the name, but I'll just simply say that I was contacted today by a guy who hosts atheists, agnostics, skeptics, etc., but I've had at least one debate on his channel. He reached out to me and asked me if I would be willing to debate one of the top agnostic scholars in the world. I said, yes. I got information today, news today, that that debate will not take place. That scholar is simply too busy. But he mentioned another really, really famous scholar who said, yes, he would be interested in a possible debate with me. Mm-hmm. And this guy is extremely well known. I'm sure that most people who follow the world of scholarship and skepticism and what have you, and Christian apologetics would recognize this guy's name immediately. So this is very, very positive. He's already expressed an interest, already expressed a willingness to debate me. So we'll see if that takes place. Mm. So that's first bit of good news. The other bit of good news, I got a call today from a real good friend of mine, a mutual friend of ours down in Texas. And he was sharing with me that some months ago, a relatively small congregation not far from where he works contacted him and asked him if he'd begin preaching twice a month. And so he agreed to do so. And after he had preached for them for just a little while, they offered him the full-time job. He was already preaching twice a month at a different congregation. Hmm. And so he told them, he said, I just can't do that. And he made a proposal, an interesting proposal. He said, how about you hire me and my brother as your full-time ministers? He'll preach two, yeah, he'll preach two Sundays a month. I'll preach two Sundays a month. And they did it. Mm. They hired the two of them. Now, both of them are, I mean to tell you, super, super devoted full preterists. He was sharing with me from the day he very first started preaching there, he began to share covenant eschatology. And he said, boy, the congregation just lit up, just super, super excited about it. And he said, the entire congregation has now accepted covenant eschatology except one older man. And he said, just recently, the elders came to him, my friend who called, and you know who I'm talking about, down in the Houston area. Dwayne Stevens is who I'm talking about. You know him, okay. Don't you? Yeah, yeah.
I don't know if I remember Dwayne Stevens.
Oh, okay. I thought you did. Well, anyway, the elders came to Dwayne and said, look, we understand that this one gentleman has not accepted this view. And they said, we're certainly not going to run him off, but we're not going to allow him to cause trouble with his traditional futurism. So if he feels compelled to leave, we'll allow that. We're not going to cause any trouble about it, because we want you to keep doing what you're doing and to keep teaching what you're teaching.
That's awesome. That's excellent. That's,
I'm telling
good
you,
good news.
That was really, really exciting news. Now, folks, mm-hmm. I've got to apologize. If you notice, I could say this is a divine sign from above that I'm good, you know. I'm pretty sure that's not what it is. I've never noticed this light beaming like this. So I'm going to have to create myself a little bit of a shield somehow to get rid of that shaft of light. So I apologize for that. Just, I don't know. I haven't noticed it before. Okay. William, what about your news? Do you have any news?
I'm good. Let's see. You know, I continue to get these comments through email. A few people who have acknowledged that they have come to full preterism, some from partial preterism, both by influence of you and myself for the most part. And I can't think of the name because I've been so busy I didn't concentrate on the name, but I got one from there, and there was another from dispensationalism. So those are coming in pretty much on a weekly basis now, people just telling us how much we appreciate it. And also I've kind of dabbled a little bit on TikTok, and there are a lot of, you know, young guys who are, you know, really getting into the preterist view on TikTok, and they're doing a really good job. Some of them have quite a few views on some of the material that they're producing. So it's just good to see that. You know, this is the stuff that we talked about years ago.
Yeah.
And now you're looking down from, you know, generation to generation. And this is about what, almost coming into the third generation of people.
Almost, yeah.
Who are understanding, learning, and, you know, as I've said once before, they're getting out of the gate much faster than took us to get out. So that is just awesome. But to hear about this congregation, you know, fully embracing it, and man, is that exciting.
Oh, it's almost beyond words. It really is. Yes. And there's another thing. William and I, on the 31st of this month, will be involved in a Zoom meeting. There is a fellow from London/France. He is originally from Cameroon in Africa, but he has come to understand covenant eschatology, and he wants to have William and me over to London. Hopefully this year. I don't know for sure it's going to happen this year, but nonetheless, he wants to sponsor us over there. And anyway, on the 31st of this month, William and I are supposed to have a live Zoom because he is inviting some different ministers, different preachers that he's been sharing covenant eschatology with, and they've got all these questions. So this is going to be a great, great opportunity for William to answer all of their questions, and I'm going to sit in the background. If you can imagine that.
That'd be harder than me answering all the questions.
But I mean, this is just some of the ongoing expansions of the horizons of covenant eschatology, folks. You know, William said he's getting emails almost every day. I absolutely am getting that kind of feedback almost every single day, whether it's email, whether it's private messages on Facebook or YouTube or whatever. We are living in unprecedented times of growth. There is no question about it. Now, I haven't gotten on TikTok. I have resisted that. I just simply haven't done it. I know that my son gets on there. I'm almost afraid to look and see what he's been doing on there, to be honest about it. But nonetheless, I do know that he gets on there and he says, "Yeah, Dad, I make some money on TikTok." And I, okay. I don't think I want to know what you're doing. But all of that aside, I know that it's such an incredibly popular platform, and I just don't take the time to do it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, it's real short messages. But
yeah.
It's interesting. There's a lot of information there. There's a lot of stuff you got to weed out, but there's a lot of information there. And like I said, I think because of what's going on in the world today is making people more aware.
Yes.
And so when you can give them some clarity and kind of pierce through all the noise that's going on, which also gives them hope and confidence, that makes a tremendous difference. And when they start hearing, you know, that message come from several people, and there are some on there who are bringing the message, you know, they're not necessarily avoiding scripture, but they're able to do it in sort of a, how shall I say that? in a way where they're talking the language of the people who are listening to them without necessarily preaching to them. And
yeah,
it's resonating.
I got you.
And so it's really refreshing to kind of hear some of that.
Yeah.
They're well capable of supporting it, you know, with scriptures, but they're doing a good job of opening that door of conversation, and people are responding.
Well, you know, you and I have talked about this, about there's almost an entire generation, as you were mentioning, of younger guys who have had a wealth of information to draw on. Your mm-hmm. work, my work, Larry Siegel, and a ton of other really good teachers out there, okay, who have done a great job of writing articles and, you know, you and I never had that. I mean, let's face it. We were the voice crying in the wilderness. You know, Max King was out there in the forefront, and he had his books and what have you, a little journal here, little journal there. But there was not this incredible amount of material. No websites. We didn't know what a website was when we started in on this journey. So they couldn't get on any websites and read hundreds and hundreds of articles free of charge. Something called YouTube didn't exist when we started out. And all of this is available. And I'm hearing from people, and this is almost frightening to me. I've had people contact me and say, you know, Brother Don, I just want you to know, I've been watching your binge watching your YouTube videos for 3 weeks, and I'm up to number 1,554 you know, out of well over 3,000 videos. And I'm going, I wouldn't sit and listen to that many of my videos.
I've had them come and say, I've watched every single video you've done. And I'm sitting back, oh, I hope you didn't watch them all.
Oh, I know. It's just, but it's amazing how the hunger that is on the part of so many people, and they're availing themselves of the wealth of the material that you and I have been granted to lay out there to produce. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so the curve has changed dramatically. And now we're seeing the growth of covenant eschatology everywhere. And it's truly exciting. Now, I want to break from that. I want to remind everyone, 1 week from last night, March the 18th, on standingfortruthministries.com, I will be debating Chris Date. The subject, of course, Chris Date is going to be affirming there is yet to be a yet future physical resurrection of the dead, of physical bodies out of the grave. And so that promises to be a really, really engaging debate. Now, I want to give fair warning to everyone. Chris Date talks a lot faster than I do, if you can imagine that. That may be hard to think about, but he does. He machine guns it, boy. And, of course, one of the problems with that is, for instance, when he debated Michael Miano, he would literally read a listing of scriptural passages, would not read the verses, would not exegete the verses and say, now, see there, that every one of those verses proves my case. Why do you not believe me? Well, I'm sorry, you know, that's not going to work at all. Somebody's feet's going to be held to the fire if somebody tries that. But anyway, I want to remind everybody once again, 1 week from last night, that's March the 18th, 7 o'clock Eastern time, 6 o'clock Central, on the website, standingfortruthministries.com. There is a link on my website, DonKPreston.com. There is a link on my Facebook page as well. And William, if you could put a link up on your websites, perhaps to let everybody know about that as well, that would be appreciated. But I can tell you this, that it seems to be getting more interest, more comments than any of the debates that I've had in quite some time. So I think people know, and Chris Date is a well-educated guy. He's working on his doctorate right now. He isn't actually an adjunct professor, or has been until lately, if I'm not mistaken. I don't want to misrepresent at all. But anyways, very well-educated guy. He has taught Hebrew and taught Greek. So, like I said, this promises to be a very, very engaging debate. And I've got to tell you, I am super thrilled about it. Pardon me. The only question will be, you know it and I know it. Neither one of us is going to be able to cover all the territory that needs to be covered. The time constraints are going to be crushing down on us. But hopefully we can deal, I can deal especially with issues that are foundational. Now, in his debate with Michael Miano, I felt like Chris Date dealt with an awful lot of peripheral things that were not foundational. And he avoided an awful lot of issues that Michael raised. Hopefully we can bring him to the trough in that regard. So everyone be looking for that. Please have me in your prayers in regard to that. This will be a really good debate. I'm convinced of it. All right. Any further comments, William?
That's about all I have for now.
All right. Well, let's get back into Isaiah chapter 49. Folks, we've been discussing the Messianic temple. Let me remind everyone that even though the word temple does not appear in this passage of Isaiah chapter 49, the concept of the temple is everywhere. Because when you talk about the restoration of Israel, you're talking about the restoration of the temple. For instance, in Hosea chapter 3, verses 4 and 5, Israel shall be without temple, without ephod, without altar, without priesthood, until the last days when David the king shall rise and rule over them. So in the last days, the restoration of Israel would be the restoration of the temple. These go hand in hand. You cannot separate them. So when we're talk to reiterate, when we're talking about the restoration of the tribes of Jacob, we're talking about the restoration of all 12 tribes. And then when we talk about the day of salvation, when we talk about the time of the new covenant, when we talk about a highway shall be there, my highway shall be on the tops of the mountains. Where do they all lead? To Zion, to the restored Jerusalem, not physically restored, but to the spiritually restored heavenly Jerusalem. That's necessary, I think, for us to understand that all of these motifs, although none of them mention temple per se, they are all dealing with that same time period. Is that a fair assessment, William?
Yes, it is. When you talk about Mount Zion, period, you're talking about basically the temple. So,
All right.
absolutely.
Well, as we promised last week, we want to look a little bit deeper at one of the other correlative tenets and elements of Isaiah chapter 49. After talking about the highway of the Lord and how significant that is, how it relates to the ministry of John the Baptizer. And by the way, there are an awful lot of passages in the New Testament that simply talk about, quote, the way, unquote. Acts chapter 9, I think it's verse 22, if I'm not mistaken. Acts 13 is another passage in which we simply find that really abbreviated term, the way. Well, scholars are generally universally admitted that's talking about the highway of the Lord, the highway of righteousness. And Paul and the New Testament apostles were all teaching about the way, and they were walking in the way. So, corollary to that, the Lord says, Isaiah 49:10, they shall neither hunger nor thirst, neither heat nor sun shall strike them, for the one who has mercy on them will lead them, even by springs of water, he will guide them. William, what is the significance of God promising that he would lead, and this is the remnant, that he would the remnant lead the remnant to springs of water?
Well, of course, this is there are a couple of backgrounds here. One would be the Exodus, of course, and the time in which God led them through the wilderness under, the hand of Moses and provided for them, fresh water to drink in the time of the desert. And so that was like giving them life from death, because without sufficient water, In the at the right time, you know, you could die of thirst very easily. And so this is became an example of God giving them, you know, water in the desert, and that translates into the springs of water or the river of the water of life that comes from Jesus Christ. I think another element there is also the emphasis from the 23rd Psalm, where he talks about leading them beside the still waters. And so all of this, you know, flows into that redemptive concept. And, you know, I don't know if people are aware, but I wrote a little book on the 23rd Psalm, but I wrote it from the perspective of the good shepherd in the temple of God, because when he talks about dwelling in the house of the Lord, and so all of that language is basically temple typology, as
That's right.
you're, you know, focusing on here, and as we see these verses develop. So that's the idea that I would see, and that is that it is that Exodus motif, as well as, you know, the motif of the psalmist in leading them to these living springs of water, and transferred to the New Testament in the waters of life.
You know, it's interesting to me because we encounter people all the time who insist on taking the language of the Old Testament absolutely literally. And yet we come to the ministry of Jesus, and Jesus says, "I am the water of life." Well, was he talking about fulfilling different prophecies of the Old Testament? You know, when Jesus stood up in the temple in John chapter 7. And of course, what happened in that, in the context of John chapter 7, we have to understand this is taking place during the Feast of Sukkot. And they had what they called the Feast of Water, or the Feast of the Pouring of the Water. And that was a very, very auspicious, very, very ceremonial activity. The high priest, or one of the high priests, would gather a golden bowl and he'd carry it in his arms, you know, something like this. They would walk out what was called the Water Gate. It was a gate on the south, southwest corner, I guess it was, of the temple, of the Temple Mount. They would go outside and they would go down to the Kidron Valley, to the pool. There they would fill that golden bowl with water. And then he and an entire multitude was with him. It must have been really something to watch as thousands upon thousands upon thousands of people followed this high priest out of that water gate down to the pool, and there he filled the bowl with great pomp, great ceremony, turned around and started back up, came back up into the temple through the water gate, and came in front of the altar of God, outside the holy place, and he poured the water out. And they chanted things like, "As you gave water to us in the wilderness, please give us the living waters." They were praying for the ultimate. They understood this was Exodus motif. Absolutely understood that as it was in the days of Noah, Moses, so it would be in the days of Messiah. So they were constantly praying for that, for the living waters to be given in the last day. So that's the context of John chapter 7. And Jesus stands up and says, "I am the water of life. If any man comes to me, out of his belly shall flow rivers of living water." Well, I wonder where he got the idea of rivers of living water. It was a constant Old Covenant, second Exodus motif. Interestingly, of course, they were going to strike him, as Moses struck the rock when he wasn't supposed to. But those high priests were going to strike Jesus, and out came blood and water, and he became and becomes living waters to all who thirst. What was it Jesus said in Matthew chapter 5? Blessed are those who hunger and thirst after righteousness, for they shall be filled. And speaking of the bread aspect of that second Exodus, in John chapter 6, Jesus talked about the manna. You know, Moses gave you the manna, and you did eat. If any man follows me, I will give him the bread from heaven. I am the bread of life, which if a man eat, he shall never hunger. And he says, and this is the bread which comes down from heaven, which if a man eats, he will never die. You know, they ate the manna, they died. Now Jesus is saying, you eat of the bread which I am. And of course, that's the same chapter in which he said, John 6:53 and following, except a man eat my flesh and drink my blood, he will not enter the kingdom of heaven. And of course, they were thinking literally, obviously, fleshly. And, you know, you know that Jesus just had to go, oh, good grief. but nonetheless, a bunch of them turned and wouldn't follow him anymore. And so Peter sort of kind of tapped into it. Lord, to whom shall we go? You have the words of eternal life. So all of these second Exodus motifs of water and bread are found right here in John chapter 6, especially. And you go into John chapter 8, where Jesus is, it is immediately after the Feast of Sukkot. And by the way, on that last day, the great day of the feast, guess what they did? They lit these humongous candelabras. Josephus says they were something like 70 feet tall. They'd have great big ladders. And the priest climbs those ladders and he trims those lamps of the candelabra. And Josephus says the light from those candlesticks, candelabras, lit up the whole city of Jerusalem. And Jesus stands up and says, I am the light of the world. If we don't tap into the Jewish festal context of so much of Jesus's statements, we just lose it. I know I did for years and years. Mm-hmm. But that festal context is so rich. And that second Exodus motif is so rich. I thought you were getting ready to check.
No, I was just saying that's a beautiful concept, you know, that correlation with Christ and that feast, and then his saying that I am the light of the world, and putting that all together is just an amazing concept, and just shows you how important that imagery from the Exodus is and how it just flows so naturally in the New Testament. If people will just take the time to look at it and see it for what it is, it's just amazing.
Yeah. And I would remind everyone of what we shared last week. There was a guy, he stalked me somewhat on Facebook for a while. He doesn't post on public forums where I can see him anymore. But he made the claim just recently that Don Preston had invented the second Exodus motif.
Yeah, you mentioned that before.
Yeah, I, you know. Wow. as I closed the program last week, folks, by saying Don Preston nor William Bell invented the second Exodus motif. Here is Jesus talking about it in John. And there was a book written by a guy named John Daly, not the golfer, obviously. Moses and the Second Exodus in the Book of John. That seems to be the name of it. Are you familiar with the book, William? Seemed like I sent you a copy of that years ago.
I can't recall. Was it in a PDF format?
Yeah.
I know you said. Okay. Yeah. Yeah, I remember.
Yeah. The guy who wrote it was a minister in the Churches of Christ. Now, this is interesting. We'll call him John. I'm not really sure at this point what his real name was. When he published this in a written form, loose leaf binder and everything, a friend of mine who knew him personally knew about covenant eschatology, but he wasn't willing to study it. But he contacted me one day and he said, Don, I'm going to send you a manuscript. And he said, I've copied it off. And he said, you don't tell anybody where you got it. So I'm not divulging a name here. But he said, you're not going to believe what this guy says. He used to be a minister in Oklahoma, and that's as far as I'll identify him. And it, again, I've forgotten the exact name of the book. It has since been published, by the way. Okay, he finally made up his mind he's going to publish it. But pardon me, it was one of those books, William, one of those works that you just sit back, and this guy, we'll call him John, for lack of a better name, developed how the feast days and the second Exodus dominates the Gospel of John.
Yes.
I mean,
Yeah.
he developed every single feast day, almost every one of them, is highlighted in the book of John. And Jesus is shown to be the fulfillment of those feast days. And as I read the manuscript, I'm going, he's got to be a preterist. He cannot fail to be a preterist. But you know what happens so very, very often? They bring their readers right to a certain point, and then they completely jump ship and they start making anachronistic applications that have nothing whatsoever to do with what they've been talking about. And you just sit back in amazement.
Yep, that's exactly right. That the Gospel of John is so I'm a lot at loss for words today for some reason, but it is so comprehensive in taking in all these huge themes from the Old Testament. You could walk through John just with temple typology,
Oh.
from Haggai and other books in the Old Testament, just through that. And then, as you say, take the Exodus and do it as well. That book just comes alive when you view it from that perspective. And as you say, Jesus just goes from one point to the next, one point to the next. And I remember when we were in Florida, I don't know if you came with us that time. This is with
No, I did not
Steve
get
and
to go to
Holger.
Florida with you.
Yeah, I had sat down and pretty much because I was going to write a book on it. And I had sat down and wrote just about every, and it was the most I've done that. This more than once. And this was the most comprehensive one that I had done. And I was using an iPad, and which I didn't use that often. And I had written out all these notes and correlations in the Gospel of John. And for some reason, you know how you get in that zone
Oh, yeah.
and things start clicking that you don't see. And I had written them all out and I said, okay, now this is good. I'm going to publish it. Do you know I lost all that information? And it was so frustrating. I never sat down and tried to do it again. So, but it's there. And I just love walking through the Gospel of John and seeing all these correlations from the natural to the spiritual, and that transformation and what it means. But yeah, it's great.
Well, what you say there, and look, folks, there is a wealth of material out there written by scholars who delve into temple typology in John, Exodus motif in John, again, festal imagery in John. A really, really, really good book written by a scholar by the name of Mary Callot, Catholic scholar, and I must confess a little bit of skepticism when I see it's a Catholic scholar, and you'll have to forgive me for that because there are many, many, many noted, I mean, incredible Catholic scholars who have done some great, great, wonderful work. Brant Petrie, who is one of my favorite writers at this present time, Catholic scholars, but he wrote one of the finest books on the tribulation that you'll find anywhere. Jesus, Tribulation, and the End of Exile. If you can find a copy of it, folks, you got to get one. And another example, oh, he's got to be a full preterist, just absolutely got to be a full preterist. Well, he's not. So anyway, Mary Callot wrote this book on the Gospel of John. And, I'm reading it with a half eye of prejudice and what have you. And the more I read, my eyes are just getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And it's just like, holy cow, this is good stuff. And so, sometimes we have to put our prejudices aside and our skepticism aside and read something for its own worth, for its own value, and realize we can learn from a lot of different people out there. And that's the way that is. And again, I mentioned Brant Petrie, fantastic, fantastic scholar. For bringing out Second Exodus motifs. And so one scholar, oh my goodness, I've forgotten his name, but the name of his book was Moses in the Gospel of John. Guess what he develops? The fulfillment of Moses and the law in the Gospel of John, especially seen through the prism of the feast days. And so you have some of this truly academic work that is available to us to understand how rich, incredibly rich the Gospel of John is. And when you tie this into temple theology and you go back to chapter 2, Jesus standing in the temple said, destroy this temple in 3 days, I'll raise it up again. And the Jews are going, what in the world are you talking about? This temple's been under construction for 46 years and you're going to build it in 3 days? So John slips that little postscript in, but he spoke of the temple of his body, which his disciples understood after his resurrection. Temple, temple, it's everywhere. But here's the key to this. Not one time, folks, and for those of you who might believe in a literal physical temple, not one time does Jesus ever speak of the restoration of a literal physical temple.
Yeah, that's it. That's it. I mean, that's just an excellent text. And, you know, you talked about chapter 2, and I remember, I think it's D.A. Carson's book, right? He was one of the, either he's the editor of that book, The Temple and the Church.
I think it is. Beale, G.K. Beale.
Beale, C.K. Beale, and then Carson is an editor.
Yes.
Of the book. Yeah. And that was a great study.
Yeah,
just really, you know, excellent insights and correlations in that book. You know, it's one of the books that really, really opened my eyes to a lot of things that, you know, even I had not noticed in that book. So, yeah, it's great to look at it from that perspective.
And so back to this temple concept that we're really focused on, even though we're taking, you know, these side trips to bring in all of this corollary information, when Jesus in the book of John is talking about temple and he's in the temple, William, would it not be a legitimate question to pose? Okay, if Jesus envisioned a yet future restoration of that physical temple, don't you think that John would have been a prime example, since so much of his ministry is focused in Jerusalem, in the temple, for him to make some comment of some kind to say, well, you know, this temple's coming down, but 2,000 years from now, the final temple will be rebuilt. And I'll build that temple, as a matter of fact. But he never does this. Total, absolute silence in regard to that literal physical temple. There's another book that I would recommend by a scholar by the name of Gary Burge, B-U-R-G-E. I corresponded with him ever so briefly. I even wanted to get him here on Two Guys and a Bible, William. I invited him to come, but when he found out we were preterists, he said, I think maybe I'm going to pass on that. And I even told him, we're not asking you to agree with us. We simply want to talk about the temple and the land. But
yeah, and do you notice how many times that we get invited to platforms that are non-preterists and we accept the invitation?
That's right. That's exactly right. But boy, they won't come and be with us. Oh, well, such as it is. But anyway, Gary Burge, in his book on the Gospel of John, Jesus and the Land, he makes some incredibly astute observations on John chapter 15. In that very, very famous passage, Jesus said, I am the true vine. If any man does not abide in me, he will not bear fruit. If any branch does not bear fruit, it is cut off, cast into the fire. Well, Burge points out that where Jesus was, according to the calculations that they did, Jesus was standing within eyesight, it's believed by some at least, eyesight of the temple. And he points out that the vestibule of the temple, okay, the opening before you go into the holy place, we might call it a foyer, okay? But you have on either side a winding grapevine, on either side going up, made of pure gold, by the way. And it comes up, and on the threshold, overhead threshold, there was a cluster of grapes, and Josephus confirms this, by the way. Pardon me, a cluster of grapes as tall as a man, Now, a man would have been about 5 foot five, 5 foot six in the first century, but as tall as a man, a cluster of grapes made out of pure gold. Now, that's just stunning. I mean, let's face it, you got a 5 foot cluster of grapes made out of pure gold. Can you imagine how much that thing weighed? Well, anyway, it was there. That was a constant reminder of Isaiah chapter 5 that Israel was God's vineyard. You are my vineyard, says the Lord, and what shall I do with you? I've dug you about, I've hedged you up, I've fertilized you, and yet what has happened? You have become a degenerate vine to me. So what shall I do? I shall cut you down, I will hew you down, I'll cast you into the fire. The same in Jeremiah chapter 2, 19 and following. Speaking of bringing Israel out of the land of Egypt, he said, I have planted you a right vine, holy, a right seed, yet you have become unto me a degenerate vine. And so Israel rejoiced in the fact that she was the vine of God. And that marvelous, beautiful cluster of grapes with the grape vines on either side of the foyer coming up and climaxing in this cluster of pure gold, that was a constant reminder. We are the vineyard. We are the vine. But what's Jesus saying? I
I
am
am.
the true vine. Well, if he's the true vine, then who's the true temple? It's not a literal physical temple, folks. And that's kind of the whole point. And like I said, Gary Burge points this out in such a marvelous way, bringing in these historical quotes from Israel's past, from rabbis about the beauty of the temple and the meaning of the vine and the vineyard and all this kind of stuff like that. It's an excellent, excellent little book. I highly, highly recommend it. So back to the point. Here we have Jesus drawing on Israel's feast days, drawing on Israel's second Exodus, and he says, in Isaiah chapter 49, Yahweh says, I'm going to lead them to springs of water. Well, William, we find this same identical context, or concept, I should say, over in a book that everybody likes to read and to study, and seemingly not very many people understand it. And that's Revelation chapter 7. Why don't you develop that for us just a little bit, and walk us through how God said, and I guess we need to confine for time's sake, Revelation chapter 7, 14 through following.
Well, in 7:14, the question was asked, who are these that were clothed in the white robes? And of course, the answer was, these are the ones who have come out of the great tribulation, and they washed their robes and made them white in the blood of the Lamb. So what he's looking at here is that multitude, inclusive of the 144,000 that we see in the earlier part of the chapter. And then he says they are before the throne of God, which is just another name for the temple. So there they are, in the temple. And the text even reads that way. It says, therefore, they are before the throne of God and serve him day and night in his temple. And of course, he who sits on the throne will dwell among them. And as you've stated, and as the text stated in the previous verses of Isaiah 49, that he would lead them to this. To these living fountains of waters, and they would neither hunger anymore nor thirst anymore. So there is the text in Matthew 5, blessed are those who hunger and thirst after righteousness, for they shall be filled. And then you have the language in Revelation 21 as well, all speaking of these living fountains of water. So that's John 4, that's John 7, and Isaiah 49, all coming together in this language. That has, the theme of the Exodus as well, but also bringing them to the presence of God and to to this fulfillment. But this is also the feast concept that's involved in the text as well, and all of that is being fulfilled in Revelation chapter 7, that shows this consummation from their trek and journey through this exodus that they have been going through and now are beginning to consummate into this new Canaan, into the new land, the new heavens and earth that we see at the end of the chapter.
Okay, great points. And maybe we ought to back up even a little bit from there and go back to Ezekiel chapter 47. Because in Ezekiel, what do we find? And we discussed this when we discussed the Messianic temple. But in Ezekiel, we find the story, the narrative of, guess what? The river of life. And it flows out of where? The temple. This new Messianic temple. And the farther it goes, the wider it becomes. And everywhere it flowed, what did it give, William? What did that river give?
It gave life.
Absolutely. Now, what's interesting is it gave life except in some places. And that's the salt reeds or rushes or whatever the term that is proper there. But the point of fact is it will bring life anywhere and everywhere. So here is the Messianic temple concept. It's the river of life. Then we come forward very quickly to Zechariah chapter 14. And in Zechariah 14, we have the day of the Lord. We have the war against Jerusalem. We have the establishment of the new Jerusalem. And out from under the throne, and as you just pointed out a moment ago, where's the throne? It's in the temple. That's where God's throne always was. So flowing out of this new Jerusalem and flowing out from under the throne of God is the river of life. And it flows, as the text says, some to the former sea, some to the hinder sea. Now, William, I want to digress here for just a moment. When I was growing up, that expression, some to the former sea and some to the hinder, that was explained to mean the blood of Christ flowed backwards and forwards. Is that the way you were taught?
You know, we never got into it give you that. Now, we've been taught that in terms of certain passages in the New Testament, but as far as the hinder sea and the former, no. I don't even think they covered that. You know, okay. there were certain passages that they didn't want us to even touch. You know, if it was Matthew 24, the book of Revelation, anything that they couldn't pretty much expound from a standpoint of, you know, hear the gospel and be baptized. If you got outside of that, you were in speculative area. And so that was the situation for the most part.
Okay. Well, I remember sermons by some of the preaching heroes of mine in my younger days. And boy, they would expound on this. And what's interesting about it is, and I don't know why this stuck with me through the years, but the very first couple of times that I ever heard people try to apply Zechariah 14 to something future, I was like, what are you talking about? That's real clearly the fall of Jerusalem in AD 70. Because the men that I grew up hearing and appreciating and admiring and following to a certain extent, they all accepted. Zechariah 14 was a prediction of the fall of Jerusalem in AD 70. That was the view of Adam Clark. That was the view of many, many, many old scholars as well. Eusebius took that view. And so, you know, it was just like, what are you talking about, a yet future temple? What are you talking about, all this stuff way off in our future somewhere? That's back there. But that reference to some of the former sea, some to the hinder, was always explained to me by the preachers that I admired. The blood, that's talking about the blood of Christ, which is the living water for us, and that blood flowed both ways. Well, that's Hebrews chapter 9 and verse 15. For this cause, he is the mediator of a new covenant, that by means of death, for the redemption of the remissions that were under the former covenant, under the first covenant. So yeah, Christ's blood flowed and covered the sins of the former covenant. That's all, and I was just curious as to if you had ever covered that before and if that was what you had ever heard.
No, you know, like I said, they didn't really get into, you know, texts like that. Apocalyptic texts or anything that was super prophetic from their point of view, they didn't, other than to say Jesus is coming soon.
Right. That was pretty. Yeah, it sounded like some of those folks that in the 1950s, I used to have a journal produced, the Gospel Messenger, or Gospel something, that was produced in Arkansas. And a very prominent minister wrote an article, and he said, "We in the churches of Christ are doing ourselves irreparable damage by not studying prophecy and the book of Revelation." And he said, "I know many congregations in the state of Arkansas in which the elders strictly forbid the study of the book of Revelation."
Yeah.
And he was going, "This is ridiculous. We are abusing our own members by taking that position." And so even though my own father was terrified of the book of Revelation, he never took that kind of a view. It was all speculative to him. And so, you know, he wasn't going to spend a lot of time with you. You study the letters to the seven churches,
churches.
You start all over again.
There you go. You know, it was through the writings of Fort Wallace that I was able to look into passages like this, you know, because he deals with that in God's prophetic word. And then he wrote the commentary on Revelation. And I remember, you know, hearing from some of the professors that I had in school saying, "I wish he had never written that book." That's the idea. That's the mentality that they had.
When I was in preacher school as well, one of our professors said, if Foy Wallace would not have been such a prominent person in the churches of Christ, such an effective debater against premillennialism, he would have been disfellowshipped for writing that book.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that shows you the attitude, the closed-mindedness, which is just really, really sad. So what we have here is this constant theme. From Isaiah 49, we have this promise of being led to the rivers of living waters. And as Williams pointed out here in Revelation chapter 7, the Lord shall lead them to the living fountains of waters. But William, that's not all that the book of Revelation has to say. Now, you hinted at it, but go ahead and develop chapter 21.
All right. Well, in chapter 21, this is the time for the new heavens and the new earth. The first heaven, first earth had passed away. And now we have the new heavens and the new earth with the holy city, the new Jerusalem that comes down out of heaven prepared as a bride adorned for a husband. And then there is the tabernacle of God. Behold, I will be with them. I will be their God, and they shall be my people. And so this is when all the tears are wiped away. Death is no more, and no more sorrow, pain, crying, or tears. And then, of course, that sort of flows, you know, that's temple typology that we see in those verses, particularly in verse 9 and following when he says, "Come and I will show you the bride, the Lamb's wife." But then that flows right into chapter 22. And in chapter 22 is where he talks about the river of the water of life that proceeds from the throne of God. So right there again is the temple and the kingdom of God that's reflected in chapter 22 and also the tree of life, et cetera, that we see in Ezekiel 47.
That's a great development. So let's try to draw this down because we're running out of time this evening. So we have Isaiah 49 and the promise that in the day of salvation and the acceptable time, the Lord would lead his remnant, lead his people to rivers of living water. Let's not forget, folks, that Paul in 2 Corinthians chapter 6 said, now is the acceptable time. Today is the day of salvation. So that means that the time for the opening of the fountain of the river of life, the time had come. And by the way, I think we just have to do this as well. I forgot a text. In Zechariah chapter 12 and 13, Zechariah chapter 13, verse 1, in that day, well, what is that day? It was the day in which they would mourn for the whole house of Israel. They would look upon him whom they had pierced and mourn as for an only begotten son. And it would be in that day that the Lord would open a fountain for the cleansing of sin. Well, so here you've got the prediction of the destruction of Jerusalem, and we know it's a prediction of the destruction of Jerusalem because in Matthew chapter 24, verse 30, Jesus quotes Zechariah chapter 12, verse 10, and applies it to his coming and judgment of Israel in AD 70, in that generation. So in that day, the Lord would open a fountain for the house of David and for the house of Israel for the cleansing of iniquity and sin. That would be in the day, according to Zechariah 13, verse 6 and following, in which two-thirds of the people would perish out of the land, and only a remnant would be saved. Well, what is Revelation talking about? Revelation is talking about the salvation of the remnant and the fountain of living waters being opened. And we have, after that beautiful, beautiful description of this new heaven and new earth, this new Jerusalem, into which all the nations of the earth are invited, let whosoever will may come. The vision is as it were, finished, and the angel says to John, these things, what things? The vision of the new heaven and new earth, the new Jerusalem, the river of living water, the tree of life. These things are faithful and true, and the God of the prophets has sent me to signify, has sent to signify that these things must shortly come to pass. So that correlates perfectly with 2 Corinthians chapter 6. Today is the day of salvation. Now is the acceptable time. These things must shortly come to pass. And that brings us back to the fact and to the imagery or question of the imagery. Could we even possibly be talking about a literal river of life, as the literalists out there, woodenly literal interpreters, insist? Well, you got to take the Bible literally. It says what it means what it says. Well, if Paul said the time had arrived, and if John said through the Spirit, these things must shortly come to pass, then doesn't that mean at least a maybe a little small spring should have been pouring out at that time, and people drink of it and never die?
Yep. All the way.
And
even Peter, you know, Peter says the same thing. Basically, you know, when you look at the fact that he said those prophecies in 1 Peter 1:10-12, oh, yeah, and then talked about the glories that were about to come, and who would say that what we have in Revelation 21 and 22 is not about the glories that exactly were promised for Christ's coming.
Exactly. Well, you know, folks, we're going to call it quits right there. We're right at the 7 o'clock time. We appreciate you being with us. We've given a lot of stuff here, a lot of information packed into this hour. A lot of verses have been adduced. I would recommend that you have your pencil, your paper, your Bible, and your notebook to go back and carefully analyze all of this material that we have given. And I think you'll find it exciting. I think you'll find it challenging, and I think you'll find it to be true. So, William, with that, I'm going to say good night and God bless.
All right. Good night.